Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. There is a good wind blowing in from California, bringing promise of new energy to the Midwest. U.S. Wind Power Incorporated proposes one of the largest wind farms outside of California. We'll have the story. Also this time, Nepal, one of the poorest nations on Earth, experiencing radical and abrupt change brought on by tourism, considered almost a religion.
And I'm not using that term loosely. There are actually posters that are at the airport that say Nepal now has three great religions: Hinduism, Buddhism, and tourism.
Jack Hammond recently returned from Nepal with stories and videotape. Also, Idaho, a state without a national park? Maybe not. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The prairies of the upper Midwest truly are a sea of grass. Across that sea blow winds, winds that sometimes rustle the tall grasses and corn, winds that sometimes howl and tear apart the earth. Now, with developments in energy technology, those winds might also generate thousands of megawatts of electricity, whether the wind is light and variable or in a violent storm. U.S. Wind Power Incorporated, based in California, has devised a variable speed wind turbine that, for the first time, can compete with fossil fuels for the generation of affordable and reliable energy. Spokesman Alexander Ellis explains.
Our new technology allows us to bid power at the 5 cents a kilowatt hour mark, which is probably a mystery to most of your listeners. But is a number that is very competitive with newly constructed fossil or certainly any hydroelectric or biomass facility. So it's a very we have the ability now to go to utilities, and really for the first time, I think that this is the first time a wind energy company can go to a utility in the Northwest, in the Midwest, in the Northeast, and say that we will develop and build a wind plant, as we call a large array of wind turbines, and we can sell you the power from that wind plant at a price that's competitive with newly constructed fossil plants.
That sounded like a good deal to Stanley Bright, chief executive of Iowa Illinois Gas and Electric, based in Davenport, Iowa. Bright says IIGE and U.S. Wind Power jointly have formed Wind River Development Company to study the wind and its possibilities.
The technology, although there's some new technology that really gave rise to the formation of this venture, the new technology is really a refinement of existing technology developed earlier by U.S. Wind Power, which is in operation at two or three different sites in California. So really our feeling is that the technology, although this new technology is not yet available, it will be in the next year or so, for commercial operation. It's sufficiently based on existing technology so that we don't think there's really a lot of risk in terms of the technology itself. We think it works. The question, though, is whether the technology can be employed in this particular region, given the nature of the wind resource that exists here, the nature of the electric utility generation requirements in this area, and really the basic question is whether the wind resource can be harnessed in such a way for purposes of electric generation so that it can be counted on a sufficiently predictable basis to make it a viable part of the energy generation picture for an electric utility company.
U.S. Wind Power operates the wind generators at Altamont Pass in California, running some 4,000 turbines, each turning out 100 kilowatts. Bright thinks the possibilities in Iowa are very promising.
You know, our initial objective is to try to get 250 megawatts developed. I don't think that'll all be done at once. I think we'll probably end up, at least for openers, developing a much smaller project to begin with, perhaps 10 to 15 or 20 megawatts. But potentially, we think the wind conditions in the upper Midwest are such that, assuming we're right, and these winds can be harnessed in a way it makes it viable to use them for electric generation, that as you go through the next 10, 15 years, 20 years, this could be, it's not going to be the answer to all the energy needs in this region. It could certainly be a major contributor.
Of course, no one knows for sure just how much power could be generated by the wind nationwide. The National Energy Strategy, released last February by President Bush, projects that wind generation of electricity will increase to 110 billion kilowatt hours by the year 2030. The recently defeated Senate Energy Bill 1220 barely mentions wind as an energy source, other than to see it in the context of other renewable fuels. U.S. Wind Power's Alexander Ellis is understandably much more optimistic.
There are several myths about the wind, the wind business that need to be exploded. The first is that it can only happen in California, and that's just not the case. There is a very robust wind resource in the Northwest. There's an extraordinary wind resource in the Midwest, stretching from the Dakotas down to Texas, and there is a very, very good resource in the Northeast. In each of those areas, we're talking about the potential of thousands of megawatts, and for your listeners, a good-sized nuclear power plant is about 1,000 megawatts of power. For comparison's sake, a good-sized coal plant might be anywhere between 400 and 1,000 megawatts of power. And we envision 1,000 megawatts by the sort of 1997-1998 timeframe in the Northwest, in the Midwest, and maybe from the Mid-Atlantic up into the Northeast. So we believe the potential's both enormous and very exciting.
The proposal in Iowa would result in the construction of about 750 machines to be sited at a location. The 250 megawatts generated would, reportedly, serve about 60,000 homes. U.S. Wind Power, by comparison, operates its system at Altamont Pass with an output of 420 megawatts to serve about 125,000 households. One of the variables in this technology, however, is the wind itself. The wind is, well, variable. Sometimes it blows and sometimes it doesn't. And this is one of the criticisms of the resource. Many say it is just not reliable. But, says Alexander Ellis,
the fact of the matter is that wind energy, and this is another of the myths that need to be exploded, wind energy is very predictable. The wind in California, for instance, is a thermal-driven wind, which means that when the Central Valley of California heats up, the cold marine air along the coast comes racing up through several passes, both in the southern part of the state and in the San Francisco area. And that is an extremely predictable resource. In fact, the wind speeds vary in the neighborhood of 8 to 10% in a given year, which is very low volatility, if you will. That allows the local utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, to apply some reasonable planning assumptions when they try to determine each year how much power they're going to get from our power plant. Now, in the Midwest or the Northeast, you'd have more storm-driven weather patterns, but our wind measuring programs have shown that too is relatively predictable. You can't predict, obviously, the hour or even the amount of wind in the day, but what you can do is predict generally the amount of wind you're going to get in a season. And in all parts of the country, wind is seasonal. You either have peak winter winds or peak summer winds. So it is a predictable resource, we feel. Then when you marry the predictability of the resource with the availability of the turbines, and our turbines are available something like 93% to 95% of the time, which means that when there's wind that is of enough speed to operate the machines, our turbines will be ready to operate. When you marry the predictability with high availability, you've got a fairly reliable resource.
The units online at Altamont Pass are at a fixed rate, generating when the wind is blowing within a certain speed limit. Below 12 miles per hour, the turbine shuts down, as it will over 44 miles per hour. The new units generate with winds as light as 6 miles per hour and can still take it with winds over 60 miles per hour. Stanley Wright says this is what is needed in the Midwest.
I think these U.S. wind power people are very good. I think they understand the technology probably better than anyone does, and I have great faith that the new machine they've developed will, once it gets into commercial operation and goes through the usual shakedown and fine-tuning, be a very reliable machine.
So whose backyard is likely to see these generators? Somewhere in a 9-state region, says Ellis.
We are concentrating heavily in the northwest section of Iowa and the southwest section of Minnesota. Minnesota has a well-documented, very, very robust wind resource in the southwestern part of the state. Iowa, we believe, has many of the same characteristics, and thus it should have a similar resource in the northwestern and western part of the state.
Alexander Ellis, Director of Marketing at U.S. Wind Power Incorporated, speaking to us from headquarters in San Francisco. Stanley Bright, Executive Director of Iowa Illinois Gas and Electric in Davenport, Iowa, says the project would get started by 1994 and, to complete, would cost around $200 million. Interestingly, neither Bright nor Ellis believe that a lack of a national energy policy, whether congressional or presidential, has in any way inhibited progress in this technology. This, they say, is a market-driven industry whose time has come. The playing field is getting ever more level. This is Bruce Robertson. The country of Nepal comprises 54,000 square miles of some of the most rugged, inaccessible land on Earth. The Himalayan mountains, including Mount Everest, in the north of Nepal, are the youngest and therefore the highest mountains in the world. Though inhabited since about the 4th century A.D., until about 30 years ago, the nation was closed and largely unknown to the outside world. But as video producer Jack Hammond saw on a recent trip to Kathmandu, the capital, change is happening in this little country, perhaps faster than anywhere else on Earth. And that's both the good news and the bad news.
For the few centuries that there have been people in Nepal, these are people who had able to carve for themselves a very, very careful, delicate balance with each other and with the land. And being centrally located between China and India, were able to survive primarily because they were on the main trade routes between Tibet and the major trading areas of India and beyond. So that was their history up until just barely the last few decades. And in these last few decades, what's happened is that the entire population explosion that the Third World has experienced so dramatically has hit Nepal, frankly, quite unexpectedly, both from the south, from migration from India, and then just in general from, oddly enough, the improved health care that Western medicine has brought into that region. Birth control in Nepal historically meant, for cultural reasons, that one would have 6, 7, maybe 8, 10 children, hoping that two of the males might survive. They had an infant mortality rate that was astonishing. Well, now the infant mortality rate has dropped, but the birth rate has not because of the cultural bias and need to have surviving males. And in only the last 30 years, the population has doubled, and that jump from about 9 million to 18 million is supposed to go up yet another 9 million within just the next 10 years, and then yet another 9 million in the following 5 years. So that's the root of where we are today as a country that's not all that hospitable for people who are otherwise close to the land, and yet now suddenly you've got 3 and 4 times as many as you would expect the land to support.
With little arable land to support this exploding population, the government is turning to a new source of revenue, one that is both helping and killing the nation. Tourism, says Hammond, has become almost a religion.
And I'm not using that term loosely. There are actually posters that are at the airport that say Nepal now has 3 great religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and tourism. And you see that everywhere. You see that the government, which has only in the last year been experimenting with democracy, has a new kind of bureaucrat, ones that are actively promoting the sort of things that they think and want will attract Western tourists. There are brand new Western-style hotels in Kathmandu. There is a tremendously impressive new airport in Kathmandu, International Airport, and some of the preliminary trappings from everything from billboards to cultural shows have all sprung into that city, into that country, just literally within the last, you can measure it in months. This is this is how quickly that's happening.
And yet, how much of the money is actually turning back into the nation? I mean, is there a certain amount of the tourist budget that is being turned back into the sort of staring at its own navel, back into itself?
Well, that's the heart of the problem. The golden egg of the tourist dollar obviously has a major constraint. When do you stop taking that Western money that you get and putting it back into building more hotels and airports? And when do you start using that money for infrastructure? Kathmandu is absolutely falling down around itself. There appears to be nothing resembling a building code. The water is of some of the poorest quality on the planet. There is, you walk through the streets as I did every morning, and there are mounds of rotting garbage and human waste and flowing sewage. Bridges are haphazard affairs. I mean, it's an absolute urban environmental nightmare.
Several things are going on, the result of this influx of tourists and their dollars. First of all, there is growing resentment amongst the Nepalese toward the tourists who are seen as intruders on private life. Secondly, says Hammond, many tourists arrive expecting creature comforts of their Western home, and in an effort to oblige and encourage more tourists, the Nepalese tourist industry is providing services that, however, extract a tremendous natural resource toll. Then there is another effect, one more hoped for than actually documented.
For so long, Westerners have taken upon themselves to be fairly judgmental when it comes to things like sanitation and building codes and such. And you really have to realize that an awful lot of the modern problems that the Nepalese face, it's because of the infusion of Western-style goods and packaging and chemicals and such. For generations, it didn't matter if you threw things out the window because the things you were throwing out were essentially biodegradable. It was, you know, the top of your carrot or something. But now, you know, Westerners have brought in plastic packaging and provided chemical pesticides and detergents and such, and the means of collecting waste and gathering and improving sanitation have, by a long shot, not caught up to all of the things that are now polluting their environment. It's crucially important that you go there with the sort of environmental ethic that people in the West are now trying to develop in their own homes, because you will then, perhaps, by your example, without maybe preaching to people, but showing them how to deal with these new problems, how to recycle, how to pack out what you pack in, how to buy and use products that have less packaging, or use alternative cleaners and chemicals and those kinds of things that don't have to have the lasting effects.
Producer Jack Hammond, living in Seattle. Hammond recently spent a month in Nepal videotaping material for the Turner Broadcasting System's environmental news magazine, Network Earth. The two-part series is titled Nepal. Check your local cable company listings for date and time. This is Bruce Robertson. Unlike most Western states, Idaho is home to not even one national park. But if some lawmakers have their way, a new national park could be created from an area known as the Desolate Craters of the Moon, now a national monument. Although the plan would increase tourism and stimulate the area's economy, it has not been received with enthusiasm from all quarters. As Michelle Hicks reports, national park status for Craters of the Moon could threaten both grazing and environmental interests.
Hi, welcome to Craters of the Moon. Here's a little map for you, and we have a 7-mile loop drive out there with some pullouts and some overlooks and some nature trails. Enjoy your drive.
Thank Park rangers like Donna Seip greet nearly a quarter of a million visitors at Craters of the Moon each year. The craters lie in the middle of the Snake River Plain, where Idaho's harsh desert landscape of sagebrush and prosaic plateaus entangle themselves in a mess of dark lava rock. This demonic landscape was first discovered by pioneers in the late 1800s. It received national attention when Boise taxidermist Two-Gun Bob Limbert published articles in National Geographic and other magazines praising its sinister appeal in the 1920s. This summer, the monument celebrated its 85th anniversary with a living history of its creation. Summer Ranger Duke Wilbert brought Two-Gun Bob back to life.
I was kind of a one-man Department of Tourism in those days for the state of Idaho. And then I wrote this article for National Geographic back in 1924. I also sent a scrapbook to President Calvin Coolidge, who was the president in those days, and I told him this place should be protected as a national monument. Well, when my article came out, it wasn't 6 months later that Calvin Coolidge proclaimed this a national monument. So I'm hoping that I had a whole lot to do with this place being here today.
Now Democratic Congressman Richard Stallings of Idaho would like to see Two-Gun Bob's idea expanded into a national park. He wants to broaden tourist appeal and hopes the dollars will stimulate Central Idaho's fading economy. Stallings has drafted legislation to present to the House Interior Subcommittee on National Parks and Public Lands. This summer, he visited the craters with Subcommittee Chair Bruce Vento from Minnesota.
I wanted him to see the craters firsthand and get some idea from him if, in fact, the craters was worthy of park status.
Transforming a national monument into a national park requires more than just switching signs. According to Stallings, the area will be expanded to give visitors a broader appeal, much like Yellowstone National Park. But in doing so, traditional lands uses such as grazing and hunting may be threatened. Groups like the Laidlaw Park Cattle Association don't like the idea. Member Harold Dressel ranches in nearby Bellevue. He fears national park status could jeopardize his family's business.
Whenever they're turned into a national park, it seems like the first thing they want to do is stop the hunting and stop the cattle grazing or livestock grazing. That's been their practice.
Environmental groups are concerned grazing practices wouldn't end. For this reason, both groups oppose national park status for Craters of the Moon. But Congressman Stallings says he's undeterred. His new legislation seeks a compromise for both grazing and environmental interests.
I think the most doable option right now would be a combination of park and then wilderness area in the surrounding areas, because that would provide the grazers and the hunters with the traditional uses and not try to impose upon the park some kind of mandate that they allow hunting and grazing in national parks. They don't like to do that.
Yet even with the compromise, environmentalists say national park status is a contradiction. Brian Finnegan is with the Idaho Conservation League.
Any place there's a national park, you will get Winnebagoes and, you know, summer vacationers. Unfortunately, making something a national park tends to be the death of it almost. And it brings such heavy traffic to the area just based on the fact that it's a national park that perhaps selfishly I would like to see... I would not like to see it made a national park just because it would bring a whole lot of additional pressure on not only that area, but of course you'd see it all through the mountains of Idaho.
Congressman Stallings believes national park status will better serve the jagged lava and cinder cones that span central Idaho's arid landscape. With an incentive of both expanded protection and economic stimulation, Stallings forges ahead with the dream of Two-Gun Bob as he attempts to secure a compromise between traditional uses and environmental interests. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Michelle Hicks.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils based in Billings, Montana. Well, that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, number 101. The number is 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.